Okay, good evening everyone. Broadcasting live.
Audio.
We're going to do another Dhammapada video. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Today we continue on with verse 125, which reads as follows. Yo appaduthasa narasa dusati sundasa posasa ananganasa tameva balang pacheti papang sukumorajo pativatam vakito. Means, who should attack or offend against dusati? A person who is without fault, appaduttasa narasa. One posa, a man or a person who is suddha, pure, and anangana, without fault, without blame. Tameva balang pacheti papang. Such of that evil, papa, pacheti goes back upon tameva balang, that fool. The evil goes back upon that fool. Sukumorajo pativatam vakito. Just as raja, dust, that is sukum, that is fine, just as a fine dust that is thrown against the wind. So if you throw dust against the wind, it comes back into your face. In the same way, evil done to someone who is blameless comes back to bite you. So, quite memorable words. This is one of those things for us to keep in mind. It's a description of the law of karma. That's what this refers to. But it's even more because the idea is that evil doesn't harm the one who is the object of evil. Evil harms the one who performs the evil. Sometimes in seeming magical ways, which is sort of what this, the story behind this verse is about. So the story goes that there was a hunter named Koka. And accompanied by a pack of hounds. So when he would go hunting, he would take dogs with him, and the dogs would pick up his prey or maybe even help him kill it, drag it down for him to kill. And so he trained them to be quite vicious. One day when he was doing his hunting in the forest, he came across a monk. And somehow he had this idea that seeing a monk was a bad omen. Seeing a monk in the morning was this idea had been spread about, maybe by enemies of monks or enemies of Buddhism. At any rate, he thought this was a bad omen to see a monk. And so the monk went on his way for alms in the city. And the hunter went on his way to try and catch prey, and sure enough, the whole day he caught nothing. Meanwhile, the monk came back and ate his lunch and was perhaps meditating in the forest. And then the hunter, on his way back through the forest, having caught nothing, caught sight of the hunter, caught sight of the monk again, and was furious. Thought, this monk is the reason why I got nothing. Somehow he had this idea. And so he yelled at the monk and accused the monk of being the cause of his bad luck. And he brought his hounds out, and he was ready to set his hounds on the monk. And the monk begged and pleaded for him not to do such a horrible thing, that he was innocent, that he had not done anything against the hunter. Part of it may have been because Buddhist monks were known to be against killing. They taught people to give up killing. And so as a result, there was this idea that somehow they were bad luck as a result, because it was something that they believed was wrong. Anyway, this hunter refused to listen to the monk and set his dogs on the monk, and the monk immediately ran, climbed up a tree, and was standing over this one of the branches. And so what the hunter did, he was so angry, he was really out to get this monk, and so he took one of his arrows and he poked up at the monk's feet. And first the monk's right foot, and the monk lifted up his right foot and put his left foot down instead, and the hunter poked his left foot and really, you know, gouged his feet. And so then the monk pulled up both feet, but he was in so much pain that he started to lose mindfulness, awareness of what he was doing, and he dropped his outer robe, the big robe that would act as a blanket, and it fell on the hunter and covered him. And immediately the dogs turned and looked at the hunter and thought, the monk has fallen out of the tree. And they turned on the hunter and ripped him to shreds and killed him, thinking they were following their master's orders, because they smelled this rope. And the monk, looking down at what was going, he picked up a stick and he threw it at the dogs, and the dogs looked up and saw that the monk was still in the tree, and scampered off into the forest, confused or maybe embarrassed at how foolish they had been. You know, that's the story. And the monk actually felt bad about this. He thought, well, you know, it's because of me that this hunter died. It was really my fault. It was because I dropped this robe on him, because I was unmindful. Do I have any fault in that? And of course the Buddha said, no, bhikkhu, you are blameless. And moreover, this isn't the first time. And he told the story of the past, that apparently in a past life, this guy had the same sort of thing happen to him. He was a cruel, terrible person, and the same sort of thing happened. He was a physician, and he was trying to sell his cures and sell his services, and no one was buying it, and no one was sick. And he thought, well, maybe I'll just make people sick, and get them to, then they'll need me, they'll need my help if they're sick. And so he took a poisonous snake and he stuck it in a tree, and he told these boys to go and fetch him this, that there was a bird in there in this hole, and they should go and fetch it for him. And so one of the boys stuck his hand in the tree and grabbed the snake, thinking it was this bird that he was going to catch. And when he realized it was a snake, threw it, freaked out, and threw it really quickly. And it hit the physician in the head and wrapped around his head and bit him and killed him. Kind of silly stories. But the story of the hunter and the hunter and the monk in the tree is a memorable one of how evil can go wrong, how our deeds sometimes turn back upon us. Now, there are different reasons why we could say this happens. I mean, the most obvious reason for our evil deeds to bring evil upon ourselves is the effect that they have on our minds.
So anger and greed and delusion, the three defilements, make you careless. When you're obsessed with something, or when you're angry, it's bad karma first and foremost, because of how it affects your mind, because of how it changes you and changes the actions and the choices that you make. Furthermore, it does affect the world around you. The second way it does, I think, is in how others look at you. So in this case, there were no other people involved, but by disrupting the monk, he brought upon himself, at least you could say, some sort of chaos, you know, in which many things are possible. You know, when you attack someone, sometimes they freak out, and it disturbs the order. But, you know, see, I'm trying to get to the point where you could actually say, well, this is a result of his bad karma, because it doesn't seem like it is. It seems like it was just a freak chance, and 9 out of 10 times, or 99 out of 100 times, or 999 out of 1,000 times, the hunter would have killed the monk in the tree. What we want to say is that there is potentially things protecting people who are good, people who are blameless. I don't know that you can, actually. I don't know that it's actually proper and true to say that. We want to, and Buddhists like to try and say that there are things protecting you. I'm not so sure. I would agree that there are probably beings, like, who knows, maybe there was some angel or spirit involved with this that pulled the robe off the monk and dropped it on the hunter. You know, that makes sense to me, if such beings exist. Of course, many, many people think it's ridiculous that such beings would exist. I'd agree that it seems kind of fair-fetched that such a being would just be there and get involved, but hey, who knows? There's that kind of thing. And so that's a direct result of karma. Other beings don't appreciate when you're cruel to people who don't deserve it. And that sort of thing really is a part of karma. Good people attract others who will protect them, attract good friends. And so if you try to harm a harmless being, you're less likely to succeed just because they're surrounded by good people. But I think you could also argue that the power of goodness has some sort of reverberations in the universe. Like, it sets things up in a certain way. I think you could argue that. I think you could point to ways in which it's true that a person who does lots of good deeds, a person who's never done evil deeds, is somehow in a different sort of train or groove, you might say, from a person who is intent upon evil. Like, they're so opposite that they're almost living in different universes, and it's very hard for them to come together. Now, it's possible, but I think you could point to that as being a reason why it takes a really great amount of effort to harm someone who is harmless. I mean, I don't want to say it's certainly not magic, but I think there's much, much more going on, and we often will... It's common for people to underestimate the power of goodness and the power of evil. Evil is something that shrinks inward or comes back upon you. Good is something that's expansive and it spreads. So you can't spread. Spreading evil is not the same as spreading good. It's much more likely to come back upon you. But I think, at any rate, I would argue that there's room for that. I think it's something that very hard to find proof or evidence even for. But I would say that there's room for the idea that goodness protects good people, and people who try to do evil towards good people, for various reasons, have a harder time of it. And it's much more likely to come back and bite them in the face. I mean, absolutely, even when they get away with it, it's far worse, and that there's no question that it eventually comes back far worse on the person who's done an evil deed towards someone who doesn't deserve it. I mean, who hasn't done anything to instigate it, who is blameless. Like if this monk had gone around setting animals free, well then you could say maybe he's somewhat meddlesome, or if he had purposefully wished, or if he had done everything he could to ruin this hunter and to harm him, he had done something to warrant even littlest bit of malice, then it would be different. You could argue, and it would be less of a weighty crime. But to harm someone is harmless. I mean, you know it in your bones. You don't have to be Buddhist to believe this. It's just far more horrific to harm someone who's done nothing to deserve it. And for that reason, for sure, it's going to affect your mind and make you blind to the dangers that you're facing, and blind to your actions, and blind to the circumstances and so on. But I think you could argue, moreover, that it's such a powerful act that it jars with the universe. As a result, is harder to perform. I'd like to think that there are things that protect people's lives, just aspects of the universe that are fit together in such a way that it's not as easy to kill someone as we might think, especially if they don't deserve it. Like the idea that, to some extent, most killing, most deeds for good or for evil have something to do with past karma, right? The idea that there is some sort of connection there. I don't think all. I think it seems possible to create new karma with someone. So if someone is innocent, you can harm them. It's a very weighty karma, but you're starting something new. And it's quite possible that they will come back and harm you, even unintentionally. Like in this case. Usually it takes lifetimes to do that, but anyway, these are aspects of karma that are kind of magical and hard to understand or hard to believe, or you know, people don't think of them as true. But this isn't so important for our practice. What's important for our practice is, as with all of these sorts of stories, the consequences. That no question, there are consequences to our evil deeds and our good deeds. I think that's exemplified here both. If you're a good person, you don't deserve to be harmed. It's harder for people to harm you. I mean, it's harder for people to want to hurt you. It takes a really base and evil person to do it. And it says that you got to wonder whether this monk was pleading with this hunter to stop for his own benefit or for the benefit of the hunter, because certainly even death by dog, by wild rabid dogs, is preferable. We don't think of it this way, but it's actually far preferable than to torture an innocent person, because the Buddha said many things like this. He said you should rather be killed and or tortured than to do an evil deed, because being killed and tortured doesn't lead you to a bad future, doesn't hurt your mind, doesn't affect you in the way that evil does. So, I mean, it's a big part of meditation that a beginner has to come to understand, that pain in the meditation, right? When you're sitting and meditating and you feel pain, pain is not your enemy. Unpleasantness of all kinds, whether it's itching or heat or loud noise or thoughts, nightmares, visions, etc. This is not the enemy, this is not the problem. The problem is evil, what we call unwholesomeness. So greed, anger, and delusion, these are problems.
they bring about things like pain and stress and suffering. And so coming to see that difference is very important. To see that it's the evil that we have a problem with. So this quote is describing a very extreme sort of karma, the evil deed that is performed towards someone who doesn't deserve it. But it brings up all these issues of who is the person who should be, who really receives the effect of a deed. If you try to harm someone, well, they might be hurt or even killed, but that's it. You know, it's actually quite insignificant compared to the evil that comes back upon you. So this is throwing dust in the wind. If you throw dust in the wind, it comes back on you. Evil deeds are very much like that. Don't think of it, right? You think if you could get away with it, hurting someone else, really bad for the person who you hurt or killed. It's actually very much the other way. And that's what this verse teaches. This is the claim that's being made. And I think there's evidence, especially for meditators, that this is very much, well, I know there's evidence, this is very much the case. I was just trying to get the idea that maybe there's even more than just the obvious of the scars it leaves on your mind, because that's the worst. But it seems that actually there are cases of being protected, where you harm someone and it actually physically hurts you right then and there. That's considered to be ditta dhamma vedaniya kamma, kamma that gives results in this life, right here and now, as opposed to the indirect, where it changes you and as a result you make different life choices and other people make different choices in regards to you and so on, and how they think of you and so on. And eventually it harms you in an indirect way. Either way, this is all part of the concept of good and evil. We're in Buddhism, in our meditation practice, we strive for good and we do it rationally. Not because we're told it's good, or because it's good in and of itself, and because we really believe that it's the way to peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. So that's our practice. And that's the Dhammapada for tonight. Thank you for tuning in, wishing you all good practice, and peace, happiness, and freedom from suffering. Thank you. Okay. We can now go live with our video. Hello everyone. I'm broadcasting live. It's January 7th, 2016. With me tonight is Robin. We're broadcasting live. So if you have questions, you come on over to meditation.sirimangalo.org and you can ask them there. No, we're not answering questions on YouTube. Today we had a meeting of the McMaster Buddhism Association executive. So our plan is to we're going to have meetings weekly, and there's a second I have to turn this stuff off, I forgot. So we're going to have meetings to get to know people, to bring people together. Maybe we'll give some teaching on Buddhism during the meeting. And we talked about these 5-minute meditation lessons on the table. Have to put the banner up. Robin I'm sorry, but something that order went all wrong because I've got rope and I've got a banner and there's no way to connect the two together.
There's no grommets or anything.
No. Like when I did it, when I did a mock order and went through it, it asked me if I wanted grommets or sticky things. You didn't get that?
So did you pick the sticky things then?
Well, I mean, I didn't order it. When you submitted, it didn't ask you if you wanted grommets?
No, it just asked if we wanted rope or zip ties.
Hmm.
So.
Oh, so maybe I missed something.
Can you just cut little holes in it? Or would it rip? Is it kind of thin?
No, it doesn't really work that way. The best thing is to punch holes and make grommets. Get grommets. Maybe we should do that. Probably what I was going to do is just use duct tape to fasten it to the poles. Not in time for next Tuesday.
No. No, you'll have to use duct tape.
Yeah, maybe we can go to the hardware store and get some grommets.
Seems possible.
Interesting, but yeah, no. It's going to be in front of a window, actually. Probably.
Maybe a big dowel, a long dowel.
What does that do?
Well, if you had a dowel, I don't know how long the banner is, but if you had a dowel, you could sew it onto it, and then it would be like a stick. You put a string on it, and you could hang it.
Sew it, like with needle. Yeah, I think I'll use duct tape.
Duct tape sounds good.
Do we have questions tonight? Looks like we do now.
We have questions. There's a question about music, your opinion about music in relation to Buddhism, but one of the other meditators pointed the questioner to the video wiki, so did you want to just leave it at that?
I don't know. Have I done videos on music?
Yes.
Okay, then let's leave it at that.
Is it possible that someone in meditation who has eliminated all desire could be so absolutely immersed in mindfulness of what things are, that he dies dehydrated for not drinking water? Do you know of any case in which this has happened?
Is this a person who's meditated with us?
Yes. Quite a bit.
I mean, it sounds like a bit of a misunderstanding of what mindfulness is. But maybe not. I mean, okay. It's not really mindfulness that you're talking about. It's because mindfulness can involve all of these awarenesses. It's more like focus, which, you know, can come from mindfulness, can come from mindfulness practice.
I don't think so. So mindfulness brings you into the present moment. I mean, just off the cuff, I think technically I get what you're saying, but really practically speaking, it's not the way it goes. I don't have the technical aspect of why it is so, but the meditator is far more aware of the wants and needs of the body. Now, they might consciously choose to ignore them, but they wouldn't suddenly say, oh, I'm dehydrated and I didn't know it because I was just experiencing it as sensations or something. That would require intense concentration that I don't think is really a part of insight meditation. So mindfulness really helps you. You're super conscious of the fact that there's the dehydration going on, and all the aspects of knowing that it's you being dehydrated are all still likely to be there. But it's just a knowledge of you know, the concepts in the mind. Now those concepts could be absent, but I don't think they're more likely to be absent just because you're mindful. I don't think it goes to that extent in most cases. But I'm willing to entertain that it's possible. On the other hand, why the heck are you asking such a question?
I have been wanting to go down the path of a Buddhist monk for years now. I have even planned to go to Nepal to travel and learn the best I could before becoming a monk. There is one thing troubling me, though, is a relationship with another person and having children. I'm not with anybody. I'm just scared of getting it to a relationship and then later in life hurting that person because I would like to leave and do as I wished before I become a monk. I don't know if I'm overthinking this or not. This has been on my mind and I'm having troubles accepting it in meditation.
I don't quite understand, but I think it's like you're afraid of getting into a relationship because you might become a monk. That, right? I mean, it's not really... I don't know what I have to say to you. I mean, so don't get into a relationship. What can I do for you? If you mean like you're having trouble because you want to get into a relationship but you also want to become a monk, well, good luck. Probably you won't become a monk. It's easy to want to become a monk. It's not easy to actually do it.
This is a question actually asked to me from Ryan. I looked on Expedia today and round trip tickets from Toronto to Bangkok started around $1,000. So with that being said, what do we need to do to get the ball rolling to buy Bhante a ticket to see Ajahn Tong? Is it just as simple as setting up another U-Caring campaign? Let me know whatever I can do to help. It is and it isn't simple, only in the timing of it. As many of you know, the organization rented a house in September to set up for a monastery and meditation center. And we did a fundraising drive, which provided funds for about 9 months of operation at the monastery, which was wonderful. But it's not enough to keep the monastery going perpetually. So we actually had planned for February to do another fundraising campaign to judge continued support of the monastery and meditation center to see if it can keep going, you know, perpetually. And that's really crucial because, you know, it was wonderful, the initial support, but what's crucial is whether there's enough support to keep it going. So that's kind of what the organization was gearing up to do another fundraising drive for the monastery and meditation center. So, you know, while the trip sounds wonderful, it's just the timing of it is a little bit premature. After we do the second fundraising campaign and see if there is continued support to keep the monastery and meditation center going, then that would be a great time to talk about extra things like a trip to Asia, which it would obviously be a wonderful thing for Bhante to go see his teacher receive the blessing and everything. It's just a little bit premature at this point, I think. But, you know, it's certainly not up to me. It's a joint decision with the directors of Sri Mangalo International, which includes Bhante, so he can certainly chime in on that too.
Yeah, I don't want to talk about those things. Leave it to you. Thank you.
All things in good time. We just need maybe just a little bit of patience right now to see, you know, what sort of support is available as continued support for the Monastery and Meditation Center. We'll be rolling that out in a couple of weeks. We had planned it as a fall campaign and a spring campaign. The spring campaign beginning in February in a couple of weeks.
I guess I'd just say that it's hard to rationalize it, you know. Flinging yourself across from one end of the earth to the other. And the purpose isn't, you know, it's not like my teacher doesn't know about this monastery, doesn't know what I'm doing. I'm sure he'd like me to come. I would like to go, but doesn't really seem worth the difficulty, worth the trouble. Especially when we have other troubles here, or challenges here that we're facing.
Well, we actually don't know if we have troubles or challenges. Your supporters, your followers are very generous. We simply haven't asked what the setup for our fundraising campaign. It was a limited online campaign. There's always a support page at the website, sirimangalo.org, but that doesn't tend to be something that people think of very often. So while there's always an opportunity to get support, not many people actually go to the support page at the sirimangalo.org website. So based on that, we're just a little concerned because there hasn't been much support in the past couple of months, but we didn't have an active fundraising campaign that was kind of out there and being promoted to ask people. So we don't know that there's a problem. There could be no problem. You know, a month from now, the monastery could be funded for another 6 months and all as well. And I'm sure the organization would really like to send you to Asia to see Ajahn Tong. Just a little bit, you know, timing.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't expecting to go. I said that I wasn't planning to go to Asia in the near future. Just kind of came up. Also, there's, it might be half part or partly paid for. We'll see. That would change things, I suppose.
That would change things quite a bit, because that would make it, you know, a very affordable way to go over and see your teacher, which would be wonderful.
Right. So there's that. That's a good reason. You know, if I've got this opportunity where half of it's going to be paid for, well,
yeah,
it's better than waiting until we have to pay for all of it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Anyway, don't want to talk about money stuff too much. If people think that's what our focus is, it's not. Anyway, looks like that's it, right?
Yes.
All right. Because we did Dhammapada tonight, so that's going to go up. Otherwise, I think Saturday I'll try to do the Buddhism 101 videos. So I have to look and see where I left off many years ago and pick that up where we left off. Try and get through that. I kind of left off because I was having trouble figuring out how to address it from a modern perspective. I think the next one is talking about heaven, which I have to study it a little bit and try and get a grasp of exactly what concept the Buddha's trying to pass on, and how to translate that for modern viewers, such that, you know, because most people aren't thinking too much about heaven, so how far do we want to take that? Do we want to have people focus on the idea of heaven as a part of Buddhism? I think so, to some extent. But I want to bring in the bigger concept, bigger context. I think the next one's going to be about karma as a result. You know, that the results of our good deeds. Why should we do good deeds? Yeah. Okay, anyway, good night, everyone. Thank you all for tuning in. Thanks, Robin, for your help, as usual.
Thank you, Bhante.
Good night.
Good night.